how can we continually improve as well as continue to feed the world, right? I mean,
right.
Global population is not going down anytime soon. In fact, it's continuing to grow. And so there's more demand for more nutrient dense protein sources, and ruminant nutrition is one of those, you know, unique food sources that turns inedible, right, forage into something we consume that's also highly nutritious. And so food security is a part of that. How do we continue to improve in all those aspects, or at least in certain aspects without giving up, you know, ground that we've gained in others? Because we've made huge strides in the last 50, 60, 100 years, right? But we can always do better.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lallemand Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast Show. I'm Travis Molinix, and today I have Dr. John Ritten from Colorado State. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you are a ag economist, or I guess a production economist at Colorado State, in the AgNext group, which is this interdisciplinary cross department group that was formed to look at sustainability. Go into detail for the audience exactly what do you do for Colorado State and what is AgNext?
Yeah, absolutely. So I, as you said, I'm an agricultural economist by training, focused primarily on livestock systems. So that does include, obviously, crop production as feed resources, as well as natural resource management. And so AgNext is a relatively new group here at CSU. Started up during the pandemic, but I've been here just over 2 years, and I'm like the third or fourth longest tenured member of the team. So again, still kind of in the startup phase. But our focus really is to find sustainable solutions for animal agriculture. And so we are very outward looking. We do a lot of work with industry partners, whether that's commodity groups, whether that's cow-calf operations, feedlots, dairies, as well as NGOs. We do a lot of collaborative work kind of across the industry. And I would say that beyond just cross-departmental, we're actually cross-college as well, which is kind of a unique center on campus. So currently we have College of Ag Sciences as well as College of Vet and Biomedical, but we also have kind of adjacent faculty in the College of Natural Resources. We work a lot with the College of Business, and we're looking to more formalize some of those relationships as we build out, you know, our team over time.
And you also have some social scientists involved too, correct?
Yeah, we do. We do, again, not directly on the team, but we do have some adjacent partners in social science, but that's actually an area we're probably going to try to build out direct hires in our team specifically, is because you can't really have any sort of impact on the industry if you don't understand the motivations of people and how and why they do what they do.
Yeah, that's a whole different discussion, but that's sometimes what we lack in ag is, you know, in scientists, that we miss the social end of some of that. I think that's a big part of the conversation today is sustainability. Mm-hmm. So let's kick us off, since, Colorado State's really heavy into sustainability with AgNext and really building a great program there. Can you share your definition of resilience and sustainability in context of beef production?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, we have a lot of grad students, we have a lot of undergraduate interns as well that come in. They really want to work on sustainability, right? And they're really excited and motivated to work on sustainability. That's such a big topic, a big term, just a big word. And so I always kind of ask three questions in follow-up, right? Is what do you want to sustain? Who do you want to sustain it for? And for how long do you want to sustain that, right? And that really gets at the heart of how challenging sustainability is, let alone, you know, not just define it, but actually work towards increasing sustainability. And so the work I do specifically and the work that we do at AgNext really does kind of focus on balancing, you know, the three kind of typical outcomes that we think of with land grant universities, right? So economic or financial outcomes, environmental outcomes, and societal outcomes. And so a lot of people think about those environmental outcomes, right? So greenhouse gas emissions is one right now. So we do a lot of work on methane, enteric methane reductions, but we also look at soil health, right, wildlife habitat. But as a lot of my NGO friends say, you can't be in the business of conservation if you're not in business to start with. And so we really do understand that if producers can't do this profitably, they won't adopt practices or they won't be there to steward that land, right? And then as we alluded to, you know, the social science side of things is imperative too. And so we also need to balance those social outcomes. It's not just, you know, a lot of times my discipline looks at kind of, you know, input output models, what are the economic drivers, you know, the tax base that we generate for a county or a state, but it's also those, you know, kind of social cohesion. You know, do we have enough economic activity to keep, you know, the park store open? Do we have a bank, right? Do we have enough kids in the community to keep the school open? And, you know, I've got a daughter that plays softball right now. Do we have a softball coach, right? My son plays soccer. Do we have people to help kind of volunteer in those regards? But even beyond that, a lot of like my social science friends will look at, you know, the individual well-being too, right? We don't talk about it a lot, but mental health challenges in agriculture are high, really high suicide rates. And so how do people actually feel, you know, the ranchers themselves, but as well as the people that work in the feed yards, the people that work in the packing houses, all the way through retail, and what are those impacts on the people in the business? And so when we talk about sustainability, again, it's all of those things. And understanding the trade-offs, not just across those three pillars, but oftentimes within those three pillars as well, right? And really trying to find a balance. But that's where I think as an industry, a lot of the resilience lies is that we have so much diversity, right, across operations, over 600,000 ranches, for example, right? And they all do things a little bit differently and for different reasons. And so there's challenges with that when it comes to coordination across the industry, but there's also a huge benefit because we do have a little bit of diversification of those risks and people managing four different things at different times. And I think that's one of the big strengths of the of beef as related to the other, you know, animal proteins, is that we do have this diversification. We have people doing a lot of different things in a lot of different ways. We're not as apt to be, you know, kind of in a hole if something bad happens. We have some resilience built in just through the diversity of our operators.
So oftentimes when we think of it, sustainability, sometimes it's a bad word, right? And so early on, sustainability was kind of a curse word in the industry of, well, we are sustainable, right? We've been here hundreds of years, et cetera. But also you look at it from, why should we sustain when we should improve? Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, gets into some context of how misleading sometimes the word sustainability can be. That you know, part of your goal is not just to sustain where we're at, it's actually to improve the entire system of those three pillars.
Yeah, absolutely. Sustainability isn't a goal, right? It's an aspiration. And so we can always improve in at least one of those pillars, if not, you know, some sub kind of indicators of those. So again, if what's happening to soil health as well as, you know, enteric methane emissions. So looking at carbon sequestration versus enteric methane based on, you know, forage consumption of those mother cows out on the range, right? And so how can we continually improve as well as continue to feed the world, right? I mean,
right.
Global population is not going down anytime soon. In fact, it's continuing to grow. And so there's more demand for more nutrient dense protein sources, and ruminant nutrition is one of those, you know, unique food sources that turns inedible, right, forage into something we consume that's also highly nutritious. And so food security is a part of that. How do we continue to improve in all those aspects, or at least in certain aspects without giving up, you know, ground that we've gained in others? Because we've made huge strides in the last 50, 60, 100 years, right? But we can always do better.
Yeah, and that's an important part. So the other thing is sometimes maybe not people in agriculture focus on this, but the rest of society sometimes focus on sustainability as methane, environmental, right? Instead of the economics of the producers, but also the viability of the communities. Mm-hmm. And farmers and ranchers play a big viability of our rural communities that sometimes, you know, even us as scientists, we don't take into account of how we do our studies, what we're looking at, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on there, right? So again, I think greenhouse gases and specifically methane right now is kind of, you know, the term of the day, but we focus on a lot more than just that, even on the environmental side. But we do also need to understand, I don't think we do a good job of telling our story, right? That livestock can be ecosystem engineers, right? We can actually manipulate the environment with more precision than wildlife can, right? Because we have some control over them. And so But that comes at a cost, right? And so, again, one of the studies we've been a part of out here in Northeast Colorado is looking at, we call it the Birds versus Beef Project. It's actually a USDA ARS project, Collaborative Adaptive Rangeland Management, looking at different outcomes, whether it's forage quality over time, soil health is one of them, but wildlife habitat. So do we provide better bird habitat through altered livestock management? And in one case, we can say yes, but we give up about 12% of beef production on a per acre, basis. And so if we scale that right across the industry, we've actually increased the price of food, which is a kind of negative social outcome. And then get to your point that we don't really think about society and the players in the industry as much. I'm also part of a project right now with one of my partners, a rural sociologist at University of Idaho, J.D. Wolforce. And we're actually doing across the lower 48 states now, really kind of measuring social sustainability of the beef industry. And he's talked to so many producers. We've done a bunch of focus groups out there. And he's really come to the conclusion that the beef industry is actually probably the single best indicator for rural health, health of rural America, because it's one of those things that spans every county, right? And we have different maybe parts of the industry, different segments in different areas. But again, the Corn Belt's really the Corn Belt with some corn out here in the West, but it's very different systems. When he's talked to these producers across, again, the lower 48 states, is the beef industry really is a really good kind of indicator of the health of rural America. And so it's one of those things that's really important that we just don't focus a lot of effort on, unfortunately.
That's really interesting. I've never thought about it that way, but it's, seems like it would hold true that, beef production across the United States is a massive deal. And no matter if you're in New York, Florida, to California, Washington, beef production covers them all.
Yep.
So I think that's a really cool finding. In fact, that the beef industry needs to champion of, we're a major part of the viability communities, rural communities across the United States. Mm-hmm. So on the topic of the social aspect, and so, a lot of things get pushed by policymakers, et cetera. So what role do you see consumers, policymakers, and producers playing a role in shaping the future of sustainable beef producers?
That's a lot to think about, but it's happening in real time in front of us, right? And so we talked about, methane emissions and greenhouse gases in general, and that's really consumer, demand doing a lot of that. And then a lot of our industry goes all the way from, cow-calf operations, seed stock producers, all the way through retail and restaurants, all the way to disposal of food waste, right? And so a lot of our industry partners in that retail space have made some sort of net zero pledge, some sort of climate pledge, right? And so the majority of their emissions are scope 3, right? Outside of their control. It's either up or downstream in the supply chain or value chain from them. And so they've kind of made some promises on the behalf of producers. And now we need to figure out how to actually enact those. But again, they've made those pledges to really in response to consumer demand. So consumers do have power in the way that this industry is going to be shaped in the coming years. Policymakers, the same thing. And so it's really interesting for our producers here in the United States, right? Because we have kind of the domestic policy, either regulations, constraints, however you want to look at that. But because we are so reliant on export markets, we have to play with those rules as well. So it can be a little bit challenging. So we're kind of in that tough spot of responding to global pressures as well as domestic pressures, which aren't always aligned and don't always change at the same time. And so producers, need to try to figure out a way to hopefully, navigate this system in a profitable way. And whether that's through financial incentives, some cost share, whatever it may be, I think we need to do that a little bit cautiously, right? I mean, beef production takes a certain amount of time, right? We don't have a litter of calves every couple of weeks, right? We need to understand kind of the long game of this. And I think that's something that we also need to do a better job of educating consumers, is that the beef system is the way it is today in response primarily to consumer demand, right? But it takes us a while to adapt and to adopt. And so as we see changing preferences from our consumers, whether, again, that's the domestic market or the global market, and including, growing population and wealth in Southeast Asia, it's going to take us a little while to respond to those changing preferences. And so, I mean, we've done a phenomenal job in creating a lot of really good, high quality beef under the current production systems. And if we need to change that response to either policy or consumers, it's going to take a little while. We'll get there. I have faith in the industry, but it's going to take us a little while to figure out what works at scale. And that's one of the things we try to do at Ag Next is we try to fail fast so producers don't. Is really, you know, innovation at scale. So what works in what different contexts, and then give us time to actually deploy those solutions and let it filter through that supply chain. With, again, not everyone has to adopt all those practices, right? Again, one of the strengths is the diversity of operators and different geographies and climates in this country. And so we have the opportunity to play in a different role in this market, you know, through niche marketing, through the commodity market, and really allow producers to decide, you know, what path makes sense for them, both from, again, their kind of resource base as well as where they want to go, that gives them, again, that kind of job satisfaction and make sure that they're happy with the direction their operation's moving in.
And I think it's some of Glenn Tonser's data, but the consumer data is really interesting in their demand of thinking about, you know, whether it's low methane beef or whatever you want to call it. And it's really segmented across the United States differently, correct?
Yeah, it is. And so we have, again, just like there's a diversity of producers, there's a diversity of consumers, and we need to continue to meet the demands of all of those. And again, some segments are smaller, but willing to pay more. But there's also people that, you know, are food insecure. We need to continue to provide, you know, accessible, you know, dense protein sources to those people as well. So again, that's one of the advantages, I think, of the diversity and the lack of integration in this industry is we're able to meet a lot of different market channels simultaneously.
I think that's a great way to put it. When you think about, you know, the cost of any of these changes, and especially with having such a small cow inventory in the United States today, is if we're driving up production to meet some of these challenges with methane or environmental, then all we're going to do is drive up some more production costs for our producers, which is driving up costs for the consumers. And so are we pricing ourselves out of a lot of markets because of beef is now too expensive and opening a door for poultry, et cetera, to get a bigger market share?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. One is, I mean, we've shown that beef demand is strong, right? People enjoy beef. And so it is also expensive, right? And so that is a challenge. And I don't want to ever make that trade-off that we're going to lower beef quality, especially the gains we've seen in prime and choice over the last 20 to 50 years, right? Is we are known globally for our quality. And so I would rather continue to sell a high-value product than sell a lot of a low-value product. We just don't win in that sort of market. But I do think that some of the things we can do, you know, here as researchers in land-grant universities, right, in collaboration with industry partners and NGOs, is try to find those solutions that are win-win, right? And again, kind of beta test some of those solutions to figure out which have promise before they get deployed commercially, and then figure out, you know, can we drive those costs down at scale as they, you know, get introduced to the marketplace. But I do think, you know, again, there's always room for improvement. So can we produce less methane? Sure. But we need to be worried about which methane we're talking about, too, is something that we focus on at Ag Next, right? So total methane emissions, right, if we are to meet a lot of these net zero pledges, whether net zero climate impact, net zero carbon, whatever it is, like they're all they're worded a little bit differently, is, you know, total methane needs to go down. But we've done some studies here specifically on grass, but also carries over into the feedlot where we follow animals basically from weaning until they're hanging on the rail, is we can decrease methane production on a per head basis, but sometimes that's associated with a decrease in meat production, right? And so methane intensity or methane produced per pound of beef produced actually goes up. And so we need to make sure we don't take such a narrow focus that we select for one of these measures while really having a negative impact on other measures. And so likewise, we would try to follow animals at least from weaning through fabrication. We try to get them, actually before they're born, if we can. We have a bunch of mothers that we track as well, because we also want to understand impacts to meat quality, right? Not just meat quality, how much, you know, total product is saleable, but are we impacting that upper two-thirds choice and prime and driving that down or not? If we can find, whether it's a genetic solution, whether it's a rumen manipulation, whether it's a feed additive, right, or a combination of all those across different stages, that's where we're focusing, right? But then also understand impacts to wildlife habitat, right? So if we change grazing management, for example, do we have negative implications for big game species that a lot of these ranches in the West also rely on for income? Or are we going to have negative impacts on threatened species that might bring some of these policy issues we talked about a second, right? So really try to take a holistic view of the industry and understand all those trade-offs and unintended consequences when we get too narrow on our selection criteria.
Yeah, you know, you just illustrate, you know, how complex the beef industry is, but every decision I make today has a downstream effect. And that has some short-term and some long-term effects. And you know, how long it takes to make changes in industry. If I make bad choices today, I'm going to see that for the next 4 or 5, 6 years in my production. And so this is where I think academia and research plays a big role in, is taking the risks that producers should not be taking. And because of that big negative impact that they can have by making some of those decisions that may be pushed by whoever saying you need to make these changes.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest roles that we can take, right, is de-risking adoption of practices or strategies, right? And that's something that we really do pride ourselves on. And that's why we try to, again, we work with producers throughout the supply chain, as well as, again, you know, processors, packers, retailers, restaurateurs. Like we really try to figure out what is this going to mean at scale. And so, again, we work with a lot of producer partners, right, and agency partners at, you know, ranch scale. So, again, the product or the project I talk about looking at bird habitat, right, forage composition, that's on each treatment's 3,200 acres, right, rather than kind of the half acre or 5 acre stuff we typically do at research farms. And so as we try to get out in the real world and do this kind of at that scale, which I think is important to help show confidence to producers that this actually does work when we leave, you know, it's not quite a laboratory setting when we're doing animal agriculture at a land grant, but it's closer than to a real ranch setting. And so I think the other thing that we also can help with is help design, you know, what does this program look like? You know, whether it's a policy mechanism or an NRCS program. Because even if we show that in the long run, this may be actually better for the bottom line of a business, there's often, right, two things. One is infrastructure or investments that need to occur to get us to that point. But there's, even if things have been proven technology, there's a learning curve every time we adopt it on operation, whether that's new technology, whether that's a grazing management system. It takes a while to learn because all of this is so context dependent that, again, there's not a typical ranch in the United States, let alone the Western United States. They're all so different based on the resource base, right? Their local knowledge, their historical context, and the path dependency that got them there, that it takes a while to understand how to apply these principles, right, at a local context.
The local context is important because you may find something that works for Colorado and your producers, and you go 200 miles east, west, north, south, wherever, and it's not going to work. And so, you know, the regionality of beef production makes it so difficult of finding one silver bullet or one solution that works across this diversity of production systems and environments of genetic type. And so that makes it a massive challenge of just finding those solutions, but also adding adoption of those solutions on that.
Yeah. And again, another example, I spent about 15 years up at the University of Wyoming before coming back down to CSU. And even just within that state, right, the southeast corner of the state, which is pretty heavily cropped. And then, you know, kind of like west central Wyoming, which is more mountainous, right? We have a lot of livestock. We have some hay production, but not as many row crops. And just if you talk about calving dates, for example, right? You talk to the producers and this one of our range specialists who retired a few years ago, right? Always push later calving, right, for rangeland health and all that. And I'd always combat, yeah, but you have a trade-off with weaning weights and all that. But then even to get back to, it's kind of that social side, right? But also that local context is a lot of the producers in the southeast part of the state are also farming, right? And so they're doing field operations starting into March and into April. They don't have time to go check calves, right? Specifically their first calf heifers, and they're worried about, you know, calf health and that heifer health. And so they need to have all the calves on the ground before they start field work. And that's, again, there's nothing related to range health, right, or necessarily animal welfare in that, but it's, I need to do both of these enterprises to make a go of this operation. They really need to make, you know, both of these enterprises need to play into the success of the overall operation. And you make a change to one, it has a dramatic impact on the other. And so even within the state of Wyoming, we have diversity in you know, what people are kind of able to do based on their time constraints.
No, I think that's makes it very difficult. And from our side of it, it makes it a challenge, but makes it a fun challenge of figuring out how to make these work across all these distinct, diverse situations.
Yeah, and then you get into, you know, productivity potential. And so just start thinking about different ecological sites, right? So soils play a huge role, even within a pasture, right? And so some of the studies we've done looking at prairie dog management is, should I control prairie dogs or not from a livestock production standpoint? And we didn't have a lot of really good data going back. And so we just did some modeling, right? Kind of figured out here the things that would matter or not matter. But then we actually had some long-term data sets, again, from ARS. And it turns out if we look at the direct impacts of prairie dog occupancy on yearling gains, it really only pays to control those prairie dogs on high productivity soils during dry years, right? And so as we get more longer-term data sets, we can explore what the nuances are. Soils matter, right? Climate matters. Microclimates across a ranch matter. And we see, you know, some of these larger ranches out there, like one area gets rain and the other doesn't catch any for a month. And understanding how and when to respond with animal, you know, distribution is important. You figure it out one year, it doesn't mean you figure it out for the next. In fact, if you do the same thing twice, you're probably doing it wrong.
Yeah, it does. And that makes some of these larger long-term data sets so important. And because we get so much variation in responses that in short-term data, it doesn't describe truly what went on. And so it makes some of these decisions that we say, well, we found this, but truly in a production setting across several years, it's not going to say the same thing.
Yeah, and exactly, especially out here, you know, I work primarily in the Western United States and, you know, in these arid and semi-arid environments, like changes take decades, right, to happen. And so any response we've seen a year or two, we actually probably didn't cause that. That's a response of climate, you know, weather pattern this year in response to management 3 or 4 years ago. And so I think we have confounding results sometimes. And so the more longer term data sets we have across different ecological systems and the more computing power we have to look at these in new and exciting ways, I think we're going to just learn more about the industry and how to do, again, continually improve how we do and what we do.
No, that's a great way to wrap a lot of this up. John, is there anything you want to touch on that we didn't discuss?
I think we kind of touched on it all, right? Sustainability is hard. It's a big word, right? There's a lot wrapped up to it. And if you have 10 people in a room, we probably have 20 different definitions of what sustainability is. And we need to do a good job of continuing to tell our story, helping people understand those trade-offs, right? And again, it's not something we ever do. It's something we strive towards. We can always do better.
Exactly.
It's time for our famous three.
So I've got three optional questions here. The first one is, what is your go-to or highly recommended book or resource for beef production?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I have a single one specifically for beef, but when I have, for example, grad students come in and really want to work on this.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac's new Bovigen Platinum Vaccines. These four vaccines deliver quality protection against respiratory and reproductive diseases in the vaccine combinations you need to protect cattle at every life stage. Bovigen Platinum vaccines are comprehensive and safe, have consistent supply made in the United States, and are backed by a 6-month guarantee in the Bovigen Platinum Protection Program. Start your platinum protection at us.verbac.com/platinum protection or contact your Virbac representative.
I send them to the old Thinking in Systems book by Donella Meadows, right? To really understand stocks and flows and leading indicators, lagging indicators, to really get people to think holistically about any system and then challenge them to really try to fit the beef industry into that model.
No, that's great. Great. So what is a non-ag book you highly recommend someone reading?
Similar vein, one that a lot of our current undergrads and grads are reading is Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Kimmerer. Again, it's kind of one of those books that really talks about the need to kind of blend, you know, academic knowledge and traditional local knowledge, right? Because they're both valuable and the combination of those data sets really leads to better outcomes. But again, thinking through systemic impacts of decisions that we make.
So lastly, what sets apart a successful beef professional from someone that's not?
The thing I try to impart, whether it's undergrads, grad students, or, you know, colleagues I work with, is challenge everything, right? So challenge assumptions. Just because it worked before doesn't mean it's going to work again. And just because we're successful now doesn't mean we're going to continue to be successful. If you're not moving forward, you're moving back. And so find new, exciting ways, be creative, ask a lot of questions. The two words I hate in the English language are I can't or we can't. Because we can, it just, what is it going to take to make that happen? And then the second, probably my favorite word is why, right? Ask why a lot, because you're just going to get a better understanding of people's kind of understanding of the system, their internal biases, like we've done this because, and they have a hard time filling out that sentence, right? That means there's opportunity for improvement. And so I always challenge people to just challenge everything, right? Ask why and don't say we can't.
No, I think that's great. I've always told students, always challenge dogmas. You know, the status quo is not the status quo. And so if we accept the dogma, then we're not improving anything.
Absolutely.
And so we're giving up so much when we accept things as they are standards. It'll always respond this way. And that's very seldom the case.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, John, thank you for the time and enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.